Maplewood Barn Radio Theater is next on KBIA, sponsored by D&H Drugstore.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Maplewood Barn Radio Theater, brought to you in conjunction with KBIA. For those of you who are regular listeners, you are used to hearing a classic story brought to life on this program. Tonight, we are going to bring you something a little different. As a public service to those who are not educated in the thespian arts, we felt it might be educational to help explain the finer points of a show to you, since many people do not get all the intricacies of a production. In pursuit of this laudable goal, tonight's presentation is Stephen Leacock's Behind the Beyond. We hope you find it edifying. The first thing that has to happen in any theatrical show is the curtain rises. This is the signal for the audience to shut up and pay attention. It is the house manager's job to quiet the audience, and sometimes this can only be accomplished by force. Large, burly ushers can be very handy for this phase of the show. Once the audience is properly subdued, a man in a check tweed suit walks on the stage. Only one man, one single man. Because if he had been accompanied by a chorus, that would have been a musical. If four citizens in togas had been with him, that would have been Shakespeare. If two Russian soldiers had walked after him, that would have been melodrama. But this is none of these. This is a problem play. So he steps in all alone. All alone. You can see that he is a finished actor. Finished about 15 years ago. He lays the hat, hollow side up, on the silk hat table on the stage right center. All this is done very, very quietly, very impressively. No one in the theater has ever seen a man lay a silk hat on a table before, and so there is a breathless hush. Then he takes off his gloves, one by one, not two or three at a time, and lays them in his hat. The expectancy is almost painful. The man on the stage picks up a pile of letters from the hat table, which doubles as a post office in this production. There are a great many letters, but he gets through them like lightning. Some of them he merely holds upside down for a fraction of a second. Then at last he speaks. It has become absolutely necessary, or he wouldn't do it.
So, San Paolo has risen $2. Rio Tinto down again. Better sell for $500,000.
Did you hear that? $500,000, and he takes it just as calmly as if he was trimming his toenails. And it isn't really part of the play, anyway. Sao Paulo and Rio Tinto just come in to let you know the sort of man you're dealing with. Then the man steps across the stage and rings a servant's bell. Even before it has finished ringing, nay, just before it begins to ring, a cardboard door swings aside and a valet enters. You can tell he is a valet because he is dressed in the same attire a stage valet wears when lounging about at home. "Did you ring, Sir John?" There is a buzz throughout the audience, and many voices say, "He's Sir John Trevor!" They're on to him. When the valet says, "Did you ring, Sir John?" he ought to answer, "No, I merely knocked the bell over to see how it would sound." But that is not in the script.
"Has her ladyship come home?"
"Yes, Sir John."
"Has anyone been here?"
"Mr. Harding, Sir John."
"Ah, very good."
The valet bows and goes out of the cardboard door, and everybody in the theater knows that there's at least one other character in the play besides the valet, a Mr. Harding. The double door at the back of the stage, used only by principal characters, is opened and Lady Cicely Trevor enters. She is young and very beautiful, and wears a droopy hat and long, slinky clothes with which she drags across the stage. Sir John says to Lady Cicely,
"Shall I ring for tea?"
"Thanks, no."
This shows that they are the kind of people who can have tea any time. All through a problem play, it is understood that any of the characters may ring for tea and get it. Tea in a problem play is the same as whiskey in a melodrama.
"Lady Cicely, have you been out?"
He might almost have guessed it from her coming in wearing a hat and cloak, but Sir John is an English baronet.
"Yes, the usual rounds. I have visited several duchesses and princesses this morning. Are you going out?"
"Yes, I must be off."
"To the house, I suppose."
This is very impressive. Lady Cicely is referring to the House of Commons, which is some sort of governmental office in England, for those who are unfamiliar with this sort of thing.
"Yes, I am extremely sorry. I had hoped to go with you to the opera. But I fear it is impossible. An important meeting, the Kafunistan business. Yes, the house will probably divide in committee. Gatherson will ask a question.
While Sir John speaks, Lady Cicely's manner has been that of utter weariness. She has looked idly at a piece of music and decided, evidently, not to sing it. The audience should be grateful. Sir John runs out of technical terms and stops. The dialogue has clearly brought out the following points. Sir John is in the House of Commons. Lady Cicely is not. Sir John is 25 years older than Lady Cicely. He doesn't see, isn't he a fool, that his parliamentary work is meaningless to her, that her life is unfulfilled. That's it. All she has is money, position, clothes, and jewelry. These things starve a woman, cramp her style. That's what makes problem plays.
Are you taking Mr. Harding with you?
Why?
Oh, nothing. I thought perhaps I might ask him to take me to the opera. Puffy is going to sing.
Do, pray do. Take Harding with you by all means. Do you know, Cicely, I've been rather troubled about Harding lately. There's something the matter with the boy. Something wrong.
Yes?
He seems distracted, moody. I think, in fact, I am sure that the boy is in love.
Yes?
Lady Cicely has turned slightly pale.
Trust the instincts of an old man, my dear. There's a woman at the bottom of it. Someone is playing with Harding's heart.
Playwriters love this kind of phrasing. They find it irresistible. Sir John is now gathering up his parliamentary papers from the parliamentary paper stand, stage left.
Talk to Jack. Get it out of him. You women can do these things. Find out what the trouble is and let me know. I must help him. I promised his mother when she sent him to England that I would.
You knew Mr. Harding's mother very well.
Very well.
That was long ago, wasn't it?
Long ago.
Was she married then?
No, not then. I was only a barrister at the time, and she, a famous beauty. She married Harding of the Guards. They went to India, and there he spent her fortune and broke her heart.
Have you seen her since?
Never.
She has never written you?
Only once. She sent her boy home and wrote to me for help. That was why I took him on as my secretary.
Does Mr. Harding know?
Know what?
That you knew his mother.
I have never talked with him about his mother's early life.
The stage clock on the mantelpiece begins to strike. Sir John lets it strike 4 or 5 times and then says,
There, 8 o'clock, I must go. I shall be late at the house. Goodbye.
He moves to Lady Cicely and kisses her softly, so softly that he forgets the bundle of parliamentary papers that he has laid down. Everybody can see he has forgotten them. What a goofball! Sir John goes out. Lady Cicely speaks out loud to herself.
I must talk to Jack.
A bell rings off stage. The valet enters. Mr. Harding is downstairs, my lady. How convenient.
Show him up, Ranson.
A moment later, Mr. Harding enters. His face is weak. It has to be. Mr. Harding is meant to typify weakness. Lady Cicely walks straight to him and looks him right in the face.
My darling,
she says. Just like that. According to the script, this is said in all capital letters. The audience looks at Mr. Harding. They can see that he is just the sort of ineffectual young man that a starved woman in a problem play goes mad over.
My darling, my darling. Darling, my darling.
Hush.
Oh, Jack, I can't go on any longer. I can't. When first you loved me, I thought I could, but I can't. This place stifles me. This house, this life, everything.
She has drawn him to a sofa and has sunk down in a wave at his feet.
Oh, Jack, take me away from all this. Take me to the Riviera, where we can stand together with my head on your shoulder, just as we did in Verona. Take me away, Jack, anywhere.
Harding smothers her with kisses and says,
My dearest, I will, I will.
While she is speaking, Sir John's voice had been heard off the stage.
No, thank you, Ransom. I'll get them myself. I know just where I left them.
Sir John enters hurriedly, advances and picks up his papers on the table, turns and strikes a pose. He sees his wife's attitude and hears her say, Take me away, Jack. It is enough. He drops his parliamentary papers with a thud, which disturbs the lovers. They turn. All three look at one another. They stand petrified.
You!
She does this awfully well, making the most of this single word.
Him! My God!
Lady Cicely unpetrifies first.
Yes, I love him. Love him. I'm not ashamed of it. I couldn't breathe, and now I'm going. Do you hear? Going away. To life, to love. Behind the beyond.
She takes Mr. Harding by the hand and exits passionately. He looks back weakly as he goes. Sir John sinks down into a chair.
Jack. My God, Jack!
As he sits there, the valet enters with a telegram on a tray.
A telegram, Sir John.
Sir John takes it, opens it, and reads aloud.
He is dead. My duty is ended. I am coming home, Margaret Harding. Margaret is coming home. My God!
As he says it, the curtain falls. There is a great burst of applause. The audience buzzes with conversation. Does Lady Cicely have the right to love who she pleases? Those who have seen the play before explain to the others how it ends, so they may enjoy it all the more. Men who have business to tend to head for the bathroom. The discussion goes on for some minutes, until the lights flash. There is a scramble while everyone tries to find their seats again. This is one of the more entertaining parts of the show. Once everyone is reseated, the curtain silently lifts, and it is Act Two, 6 months later. Programs rustle. The people look to see where it is, and they find that it is an apartment in Paris. The very words give the audience a delicious shiver of uncomfortableness. When the curtain rises, it discloses a French maid. We know this because she is wearing a little French maid's outfit, setting things on a table, evidently for supper. There has to be a supper scene. It is symbolic. It symbolizes hearth and home and fooling around. As the maid moves about, there is a loud knock at the cardboard door of the apartment. A man in official clothes sticks his head in. He is evidently a postman because he is delivering a letter. The maid lays the letter on the supper table. Just as she does this, the door opens and there enters Mr. Harding and Lady Cicely. Yes, them. Both of them. The audience catches it like a flash. They live here. Lady Cicely is very bubbly. She pours champagne into Mr. Harding's glass.
Well, are you a happy boy now?
Oh, yes, my darling.
Now and then, though, Lady Cicely has a coughing fit and presses her hand to her side. Mr. Harding looks at her apprehensively.
It is nothing, silly boy. It will be gone in a moment.
Coughing fits are nothing when you are this happy. Then suddenly Mr. Harding sees the letter lying on the supper table. It has been lying right beside him for 10 minutes, but he has been completely oblivious. Now he clutches it and tears it open. There is a haunted look in his face as he reads.
What is it?
My mother. Good God. She is coming here. What can I do?
Does she know about us?
No, nothing.
How did she find you?
I don't know. I can't imagine. When I read in the papers that my father was dead, I knew she would come home. But I told the solicitors to keep the address secret. Curse them.
Mr. Harding paces the stage, giving an imitation of a weak man trapped. He keeps muttering.
Oh, what can I do? What can I do?
There is only one thing to do, Jack. Tell her.
Tell her?
Yes. Tell her about our love. About everything. I am not ashamed. Let her judge me.
I tell you, I can't. I can't. She wouldn't understand.
The letter is fluttering in his hand. His face is contemptible. He does it splendidly. Lady Cicely snatches the letter from his hand. She reads it aloud, her eyes widening as she reads.
Hotel Bristol. My darling boy, I have found you at last. Why have you avoided me? God grant there is nothing wrong. The man I taught you to call father is now dead. And I can tell you everything. I am on my way to see you, Margaret Harding.
Lady Cicely's voice chokes with horror. She advances on Jack.
What does this mean, Jack? Tell me, what does it mean?
Good God, Cicely, don't speak like that.
These lines about your father.
I don't know what it means. I don't care. I hated him, the brute. I'm glad he's dead. I don't care about that. But she's coming here any minute, and I can't face it.
Jack, tell me, did Sir John Trevor ever talk to you about your father?
No, he never spoke of him.
Did he know him?
Yes, I think so, long ago. But they were enemies. Trevor challenged him to a duel over some woman, and he wouldn't fight, the cur.
I understand it now. Listen, there is time yet. Go to the hotel. Go at once. Tell your mother nothing. Nothing, you understand? Keep her from coming here. Anything, but not that.
She hurriedly gets Harding's hat and coat. The stage is full of bustle. There is a great sense of hurry. Mr. Harding goes to kiss Lady Cicely, but she pushes him away in horror and hastens him out. She then speaks to the little French maid.
Ernestine, quick, put my things, anything, into a valise.
Madame is going away?
Yes, yes, at once. Summon a taxi. I shall be ready in a moment.
Lady Cicely passes through a side door into an inner room. She is scarcely gone when Mrs. Harding enters. She is a woman about 45, still very beautiful. She is dressed all in black. The play is now moving very fast. You have to pay close attention to follow it all. Mrs. Harding speaks to the French maid.
Is this Mr. Harding's apartment?
Yes, madame.
Is he here?
No, madame. He is gone this moment in a taxi to the Hotel Bristol, I heard him say.
Is anyone here?
No, madame, no one. Milady was here a minute ago. She, too, has gone out.
This is a lie, but of course the maid is French.
Then it is true. There is someone.
She is just saying this when the bell rings. The door opens and Sir John Trevor enters.
You!
I am too late.
After all these years.
It has been a long time.
You have not changed. I have thought of you so often in all these bitter years. It sustained me even during the worst. And I knew, John, that it was for my sake that you had never married.
Then, as she goes on jabbering, the audience realizes with a thrill that Mrs. Harding does not know about Sir John's marriage 2 years ago. And they get another thrill when they realize Lady Cicely has pushed the door half open and is standing there unseen, listening. She wears a hat and cloak. There is a folded letter in her hand. Her eyes are wide. Mrs. Harding continues.
And now, John, I want your help. Only you can help me. You are so strong. My Jack, I must save him. Oh, John, this place, his being here like this, it seems a judgment on us.
The audience is catching on now. And when Mrs. Harding speaks of our awful moment of folly and the retribution of our sins, they grasp it and shiver with delight.
Our wretched boy. We must save him.
They all know why she says our boy.
He is not here alone.
He is not alone.
But this woman, can you deal with her, persuade her, beg her for my sake, bribe her to leave my boy?
Lady Cicely steps out.
There is no need for a bribe. I am going. If I have wronged him and you, it shall be atoned.
Sir John is standing stunned. She turns to him.
I have heard now and know all. I cannot ask for pity, but when I am gone, when it is over, I want you to give him this letter, and I want you, you two, to be together as if I had never lived.
She lays the letter in his hand. Then, without another word, Lady Cicely exits. There is a great stillness in the house. Mrs. Harding has watched Lady Cicely and Sir John in amazement. Sir John has sunk into a chair. He does a lot of sinking in this production.
John, for God's sake, what does it mean? This woman, there is something awful brewing. I must know.
Yes, you must know. It is fate, Margaret. You do not know all. 2 years ago, I married.
But this woman...
She was my wife.
And at this moment, Harding bursts into the room.
Cicely, I was too late. Mother, and you, Sir John, where is she? What is happening? I must know.
Sir John hands Harding the letter. He tears it open and reads.
Dearest, I am going away to die. It cannot be long now. The doctor told me today. That was why I couldn't explain it to you, and acted strange at dinner. But I am glad now. Goodbye. What have you done, Sir John? Why have you driven her away? I loved her. She was mine.
Harding has seized a pointed knife from the supper table. His shoulders are crouched. He is about to spring on Sir John. Mrs. Harding has thrown herself between them.
Jack! Jack! You mustn't strike!
Out of the way, I say! I'll...
Jack! Jack, you mustn't! Can't you understand? Don't you see what it is?
What do you mean? Stand back.
Jack! He is your father!
The knife clatters to the floor.
My God.
Then the curtain falls, and there's a burst of applause. Many of the men, who have been drinking heavily, once again sneak out to the bathroom. Everybody is wondering how it will come out, or rather, how it can possibly come out at all, with some of them contending that it's all wrong. And just as they are making it clear that there shouldn't be any third act, the curtain goes up, and it's Act 3, 3 months later. The curtain rises on a drawing room in Mrs. Harding's house in London. Mrs. Harding is sitting at a table, sorting out parcels.
For the Orphans' Home, poor little things. For the Foundlings' Protection Society. For the Lost Infants' Preservation League. Poor, poor children.
Now, what is all this about? What has this to do with the play? Why, don't you see that it is the symbol of philanthropy, of gentleness, of melancholy sadness? The storm is over, and there is nothing in Mrs. Harding's heart but pity. Don't you see that look on her face? That third act air of resignation? Don't you see that the play is really all over? They're just letting the wind out of it. The valet announces, Sir John Trevor, madam.
Sir John, my dear, dear friend.
Sir John is all in black. He is very quiet. You can feel that he's been spending the morning with the Directorate of the Lost Waifs Encouragement Association. In fact, he begins to talk of these things at once. The people who are not used to third acts are wondering what it is all about. The real playgoers know that this is atmosphere. Then presently...
Tea? Shall I ring?
Pray do.
He seats himself with great wariness. The full melancholy of the third act is on him.
You have news, I know. You have seen him?
I have seen him.
And he is gone?
Yes, he has sailed. He went on board last night, only a few hours after my return to London. I saw him off. Poor Jack. He will work at the embassy in Lima. There he can begin life anew.
He will do well in Peru?
Yes, I trust so.
There is silence again. In fact, the whole third act is diluted with 30% silence. Presently, Mrs. Harding speaks again.
You have other news, I know.
Yes, I have other news.
Of her?
Yes. I have been to Switzerland. I have seen the doctor, a good man. He has told me all there is to tell. He led me to her grave.
Lady Cicely, dead! Everybody in the theater gasps, dead! But what an unfair way to kill her! To face an open death on the stage in fair hand-to-hand acting is one thing, but this new scheme of dragging off characters to Switzerland between acts and then saying they are dead is quite another.
And what of you? You will take up your work here again?
No, no. I am going away.
Going? Away?
Yes. Far away. I am going to Kafunistan.
To Kafunistan?
Yes, to Kafunistan. And you? You will settle down here in London?
No, I am going away.
Good Lord, going away?
Yes, back to Balawala. I want to be alone. I want to forget. I want to think. I want to refind myself.
You are going alone?
Yes, quite alone. But I shall not feel alone when I get there. The Maharini will receive me with open arms.
Margaret, you must not do this. You have sacrificed your life enough. You have the right to live.
There is emotion in Sir John's tone. It is very rough on him to find his plan of going to Kafunistan has been outdone by Mrs. Harding's going to Balla Walla. She shakes her head.
No, no, my life is of no account now. But you, John, you are needed here. The country needs you. Men look to you to lead.
No, no, my work lies there in Kafunistan. There is a man's work to be done there. The tribes are ignorant, uncivilized.
This dialogue goes on for some time. Mrs. Harding keeps shaking her head and saying that Sir John must not go to Kafunistan, and Sir John says she must not go to Balla Walla.
No, you must not go to Kafunistan. The people need you here.
But there is much to do in Kafunistan. There is work there for me. You, however, cannot go to Balla Walla. Your delicate constitution will not tolerate it.
But I need the time away so I can think clearly again.
This is all a bluff. They are not leaving. Neither of them. And everybody knows it. Presently, Mrs. Harding says,
"You will think of me sometimes?"
"I shall never forget you."
"I'm glad of that."
"Wherever I am, I shall think of you. Out there in the deserts, or at night, alone there among the great silent hills with only the stars overhead, I shall think of you. Your face will guide me wherever I am. And will you think of me sometimes in Balla Walla?"
"Yes, always. All day while I am with the Maharini and her women, and at night, the great silent Indian night, when the people of the palace are asleep and there is nothing to be heard but the sounds of the jungle, the cry of the hyena and the bray of the laughing jackass, I shall seem to hear your voice."
They move toward each other.
"Margaret."
"John."
"I cannot let you go. Your life lies here with me. Next to my heart, I want your help, your love here, inside the beyond."
And as he speaks and takes her in his arms, the curtain sinks upon them, rises while the players step out and take a bow, then falls again, and the play is over. The lights come up, the audience rises as one. All over the theater you can hear the words, "perfectly rotten," "utterly untrue," and so on. The general judgment seems to be that it was a terrible play. But just inside the theater, in the office, is a man adding up dollars with a blue pencil, and he knows that the play is a good one. And so it is a happy ending for all concerned, except, of course, the audience. We hope you have enjoyed this presentation of Behind the Beyond by Stephen Leacock. Our players were Dave Collins as Sir John, Allison Cassio as Lady Cicely, Jason Cassio as the valet, Michael Scott as Jack Harding, Alana Berrigan-Scott as Mrs. Harding, and Molly Dodge as the little French maid. This is your narrator, Jason Cassio. The show was adapted for audio presentation by Brad Buchanan, and our engineer was Darren Helwich. Join us again next week when Maplewood Barn Radio Theater will present another classic story right here on KBIA.
And Maplewood Barn Radio Theater was brought to you this week on KBIA by D&H Drug Stores.